The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
It's almost 30 years since the death of Princess Diana, a moment that changed the royal family, the British public, and the way we all think about the monarchy. Diana died 29 years ago tomorrow on a Sunday very much like this one. In the years since, her story has continued to shape the royal family, from William and Harry's very different paths to Harry and Meghan stepping away from royal duties and publicly criticising the institution. So how much has the monarchy really changed since Diana's death, and how much of what we see today can be traced back to that fatal day 29 years ago tomorrow? Enda Brady, journalist and broadcaster, joins us now to look at Diana's enduring legacy, the royal family today, and the latest chapter in the Harry and Meghan story. Enda, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks for having me again.
Now, it was that moment that we all remember. I mean, you can go back to the Kennedy assassination, which we were talking about on yesterday's programme, or even people saying they will always remember where they were when they heard that Dolly Parton died this week. But the moment that we all woke up on a Sunday morning to hear the news that Diana had been involved in a car accident, that was a moment that anyone living and conscious at that time will never forget.
Absolutely. Well said, Pat. It was seismic. It was so shocking. And just wall-to-wall coverage. And if you think back, you know, the late Queen Elizabeth II deciding to stay initially in Scotland, I think the royal family got so much wrong at that time because there's no manual for grief and there's no manual for how you handle such a crisis. But before, they did not come out of it very well.
Before we go to the aftermath, let's relive some of those moments from reportage of the time.
The Press Association in Britain, citing unnamed British sources, has reported that Diana, Princess of Wales, has died. And as soon as there is any further news, we will bring it to you.
By bus, by tube, public transport, most of them have walked here, some have come in limousines. They've come anyway, just to be here, or to leave a single flower or a bouquet.
It's not just what you've done for us that makes us love you so. It's all the joy of who you are, the friend we've come to know.
These people are coming from all over the country. I've been speaking to the ladies that come down from Newcastle, from Liverpool, and they feel they've got no reason, but they just feel they had to come down.
Our thoughts are also with Diana's family and the families of those who died with her. I know that they too have drawn strength from what has happened since last weekend as they seek to heal their sorrow and then to face the future without a loved one. I hope that tomorrow we can all, wherever we are, join in expressing our grief at Diana's loss and gratitude for her all-too-short life. It is a chance to show to the whole world the British nation united in grief and respect. May those who died rest in peace, and may we, each and every one of us, thank God for someone who made many, many people happy.
And strangely enough, the tone that the Queen struck at those moments seems all wrong, doesn't it?
Completely. I mean, just listening back to that now, the speed with which it's delivered. I mean, if you were coaching someone in terms of how to speak or land a message, it just seemed like she couldn't get that speech delivered quickly enough and get back to something more important. If you think back to Tony Blair, the words that came out of Blair's mouth, who was Prime Minister at the time and only new into the job, his speech had been written by Alistair Campbell, and Campbell came out with the line for Blair, "She was the people's princess, the queen of our hearts." You know, as a politician, you know, kind of possibly skin deep emotion from a newly elected prime minister who didn't know the woman very well. He struck a far better and measured tone in what he said, Tony Blair.
Now, let's talk about Diana herself. I mean, those who are younger will know her maybe from pictures, and they might have seen old editions of Hello magazine. I mean, she was everywhere. She was royal glamour that we'd never seen before.
She was the most photographed woman on earth, probably the most photographed person in the world at the time for years. Everything she did made the news. You know, if you think of charities that previously had not been that fashionable and had not gained much media traction, whether it was AIDS, HIV, or landmines in Africa, whatever Diana championed, made front page news. You had charities queuing up to have a visit or to just have her on their premises because they knew the profile would come, the media attention would come, and with it, the cash and the money and the help and support. So she was an extraordinary woman. And she, when she decided she'd had enough of the royal family, I think she, on a PR level, she certainly ran rings around them, and she made the royal family change because they realised that they needed some proper comms professional help to help tell their story.
And she was remarkably brave in her own way. I'm sure when she was walking through landmines as part of her campaign, she was well looked after. But there were other things that she did when she embraced a man who was dying of AIDS. You know, no one really understood the nature of that condition, but she was fearless in trying to convey to the public, this, you know, is a condition that we should all work very hard to try and come to terms with, and no one is to be condemned for having been afflicted by it.
Yes, she was an extraordinarily resilient woman, deeply compassionate, and the way she went about things, and, you know, the famous pictures of her, as you say, embracing a man with HIV/AIDS. This was at a time when there wasn't the education there is nowadays. You know, people just did not know that much about the virus. And Diana doing that, as you know, I think it got a lot of people talking and a lot of people thinking. She broke down barriers and she was able to communicate with ordinary people on a level that nobody in the royal family has ever been able to do before or since.
She was also an unusual royal mother in that she was raising the man, or the boy who would become the man, Prince William, who would ultimately become king. But she tried to give them a fairly normal life. I mean, she was a very public mom. She went to fun fairs with them and brought them places, holidayed with them very publicly. They enjoyed her. She enjoyed them. And that was something different. It wasn't the kind of austere royal upbringing that we'd seen to heretofore, the kind of upbringing that Prince Charles certainly had.
Yes, if you look at how Charles and his siblings were raised and, you know, being dispatched off to boarding schools in Scotland and very little motherly attention, Queen Elizabeth II, you know, famously heading off on tours of the Commonwealth and Africa and Australia and these places and not seeing Charles for 4 to 6 weeks, and the other children as well. Whereas Diana put the children at the front and centre of her life and wanted them to have an ordinary or as ordinary an upbringing as they could have, going to fun fairs, going on roller coasters, you know, all the wonderful pictures of a mother enjoying her children and wanting them to have the kind of days out that ordinary children have in the summer holidays too.
And then 29 years ago tomorrow, everything changed, and we saw the outpouring of public affection for Diana in her death, which I think was real and never really changed even as time has elapsed. She is still, I think, held in great public affection by those who knew her at the time. But then the images of her sons walking behind her coffin broke people's hearts.
They did. And you just think back, who made that decision? That would not happen nowadays. I mean, times have changed incredibly so and for the better. But that, you know, as Harry has alluded to in his book and various different interviews, you know, was that the right thing to do? Two small children, the eyes of the world, the whole of London, people wailing in the street, the noise, people throwing flowers and roses at the cortege and the hearse, you know, just images that you just cannot believe. If such a situation were to happen nowadays, they just would not do that with the current crop of heirs and spares.
Now, the evolution then of the royal family, I mean, Charles marries Camilla, he becomes ultimately king, she becomes queen, which would have been unthinkable, I suspect, had Diana lived, even though a divorce, etc., in play. The idea of a Queen Camilla, while there might be, and they're now talking about Harry's alternative court, if there was a Diana court somewhere.
Yes, I think if you go back 29 years ago, Charles and Camilla certainly did not enjoy the levels of popularity they have now. And you've seen an incredible, very sophisticated, intelligent PR campaign to rehabilitate Camilla and Charles. And, you know, she now has the title Queen, even though if you stop someone in England or anywhere in the UK and say, who's the Queen? I think a lot of people would say Queen Elizabeth II. That title is hers forever. I think we've seen clever recruitment of media professionals into the royal household. I mean, Charles has recently recruited Rhiannon Mills, who I spent many happy years with at Sky News, brilliant royal correspondent. She's now one of their principal advisors. So you're seeing the royals kind of move into the 21st century belatedly. And that has really helped, you know, tell the story. And you know, if you think back 29 years ago, there was no prospect of Camilla becoming queen. She was vilified. And the really strange thing I find, having attended a few functions and garden parties over the years with these people and just observed them, Camilla can work a room like no human I have ever seen. She has a word for everyone. Charles seems to be far more at ease with nature and particularly with dogs. He just, you know, he's not a human, you know, he's far happier around animals and nature than he is around people. Whereas Camilla is just nonstop. A little gag, a word here, a smile, a handshake. She works the room. She's an absolute force of nature on the PR front.
And that is not something you can learn. That's innate in her, I suspect, that she was probably always that kind of person, gregarious and personable. Now, what about the two boys? I mean, are William and Harry, at the papers say they're not speaking to each other. Is that actually true?
There hasn't been a word spoken in 4 years, is what I've been told. It's dead in the water. As far as William's concerned, it is dead in the water. There is no relationship. And look, you're seeing surveys and polls about who should reach out first, and the British public want William and Harry to be friends and to kiss and make up. I think there has been so much hurt and damage caused on both sides that it is an irretrievably broken down relationship now.
And yet, to borrow from Irish politics, we saw Desi O'Malley and Charles Haughey form a government together, you know, so nothing is impossible. The question of Harry, though, and what his life is going to bring, I mean, can he become a working royal again? Is he liked? Is he admired?
I think Harry needs some good guidance. I don't think the option of going back into the royal family is ever going to happen, because William is driving this family, he's driving the narrative, and as much as Charles is king, this is a royal family completely in control of William, William's control, and he is driving everything. So you will see Harry, I think, trying to reach out, trying to do more. Is he popular? I think he needs to stop with the negativity and the moaning and the constantly kind of criticizing everything. He seems to be a very angry young man. And yes, a lot of that is completely understandable. I think Harry's best bet now is to get involved with perhaps military charities, veterans and veterans' mental health, homelessness to do with the ex-military in the UK, and to throw himself completely into his Invictus Games in Birmingham next year. I think on one level, people do like him. The problem is a lot of people in the UK don't like Meghan. And that narrative is driven by certain sections of the right-wing newspaper media here.
Finally, we are expecting a new book from Charles Spencer, Diana's brother. He was the man who famously coined the phrase about Diana the Huntress becoming the hunted at the hands of the media subsequent to her death. Is that book, what we know of its contents, going to cause ripples or tidal waves?
Well, what we don't know, Pat, is the extent of the relationship, if any, between Charles Spencer and his former brother-in-law, King Charles. Have they spoken? Has the palace cleared this book? Does the palace even know what's in it? I haven't been picking up on any kind of concern or anxiety behind the scenes, having spoken to people who work for the royal family. So I think there won't be any bombshell announcements, but Charles Spencer clearly has his view on how his sister was treated by everyone, including the family she married into and the UK press at the time. The book is called Swan Song. It's Diana's story as told by her brother and someone who very much views himself as guardian of her reputation and legacy. It's out in 3 weeks' time. The publishers are saying there will be new revelations. But look, they've got a book to sell, so they would say that. I think it'll be interesting. I think what we're likely to see is a lot of family stuff, early photographs and family stories before she married into the royal family.
Lastly, I suppose we should look at the broader royal family around Europe and the death of King Harald in Norway. And when you start scratching below the surface and not too deeply, you realise they're all related.
Yes. So King Harold, who died the other day at the age of 89, was actually a second cousin of Queen Elizabeth II. So you're right. They're all interconnected. There will be UK representation clearly at that funeral when it happens in Norway. But you're right. They're all intermarried, interrelated, and they all know each other very, very well. So I'd just be curious to see if Harry turns up in Oslo. That's all.
It's interesting that they decided, the Norwegians did, on the formation of their own state as distinct from Sweden, which used to boss them. They decided themselves to have a royal family, but only when the identity of those particular royals was found. And that included Maud, who was the King of England's daughter and therefore related directly back to Victoria. So they like to keep things in the family.
Yeah, and it hasn't changed since.
All right. And Brady, journalist and broadcaster, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
With Timber Living Log Cabins.